So tonight we're very pleased to have Alison Howie talk to us. Main focus is the Save the Species program and how that operates, and with reference to specific species to Bathurst, earless, a grass named earless dragon and the purple pop-up butterfly. Alison is calling in from Ilford, which is also one more Wiradjuri land, as most of us are, so I'll let her do the acknowledgement of the country. And Alice started working at the Biodiversity Conservation Trust just post-completing her master's, and she says it's her dream job. So, Alison, if you could tell us about your dream job, we'd love to hear.
Thanks, Tony. So I guess before diving into my presentation, I'll talk a little bit about why I'm interested in this. I first heard about Saving Our Species when I was doing my master's, and it just struck me as an amazing idea and opportunity that there's a funded program to do on-ground conservation work in New South Wales. So took a couple of years to get the job. I worked in the offset space in government to start out with, and that was a really good starting point to learn a bit about how the department works. And then about 2 years ago, I secured the role as a threatened species officer. So I'll dive in. Thank you for having me here. I'm part of the Northwest Ecosystems and Threatened Species team in the Conservation Programs Division of New South Wales, DEQ. It's a long name now, a bit of a mouthful. It's the Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water. And the largest component of my role is implementing the Saving Our Species program. So I'll start this evening by giving you a quick intro to Saving Our Species. Then I'll present on two of my project species, as Tony said, the Bathurst grass and earless dragon and purple copper butterfly. I'll just let you know, I'm really happy to take questions along the way, especially if you're liable to forget your question before the presentation ends. If you're here virtually, you can put your hand up, or if you're in the room, you can sort of wave around or sing out, and I'm happy to answer questions along the way. Otherwise, happy to answer any questions at the end of the presentation too. Before I go any further, I'd like to acknowledge country. Wherever we're joining from, we are on Aboriginal land. As Tony said, I'm on Wiradjuri country also, and I pay my respects to elders past and present. I extend that respect to all First Nations people. I'd also like to acknowledge that many of the conservation challenges we work on today reflect profound changes to Australia's landscape since European settlement. And understanding that history helps provide context for the work of protecting and restoring biodiversity. Finally, a quick note that I'll be talking from a Western scientific perspective. That's the background I've been trained in and the lens I work through professionally. It's certainly not the only way of understanding the environment, but it's the perspective I'm best placed to speak about tonight. So, Saving Our Species. This program commenced in 2013 with the intention of securing threatened species and ecological communities into the future. Under the Biodiversity Conservation Act 2016, which is New South Wales legislation, a formalised biodiversity conservation program is required. At present, and hopefully well into the future, Saving Our Species is this program. Since commencement, the program has delivered a 400% increase in the number of species managed on ground. But this is not a one-size-fits-all approach, as threatened species have different conservation needs, depending on their ecology, habitat and distribution, the threats to their survival, and how much we know about them. For this reason, species and communities managed under the program are placed in one of nine management streams, depending on their specific needs. Site-managed species like the purple copper butterfly are protected by locating them at specific sites. This allows critical threats to be managed within known habitat. species like the Bathurst grass and Eelas dragon are allocated to the data deficient management stream, as there's relatively little knowledge of their ecology, distribution, threats, or management needs. Typically, data deficient species need investment in targeted research or surveys to fill knowledge gaps and determine the best approach to on-ground management. You can find more information on the framework for all of these management streams by heading to the Saving Our Species webpage. Importantly, Saving Our Species aims not only to conduct on-ground management actions, such as species monitoring, weed control, and seed collection, but also to fill knowledge gaps for all species it manages so that we can improve conservation actions and plans into the future. Each entity within all of the nine management streams has a plan for monitoring and evaluation to help us assess the health of the species or community and determine what management is needed to improve conservation outcomes. So, as I mentioned, I've been working in the SOS program for about 2 years now, and these are the main strengths that I've benefited from with the projects I manage or co-manage. We have strong partnerships with other agencies like national parks and local land services who manage many of the lands on which threatened species occur. And in many cases, sites are co-managed to conserve those threatened species. We regularly collaborate with community engagement and awareness raising opportunities. Local land care associations are also fantastic partners and often provide us with in-kind support, especially with community engagement. Saving Our Species also benefits from dedicated communication staff who do the behind-the-scenes work to create brochures and fact sheets, enable media stories, support awareness-raising campaigns, and generally think of creative ways to get the community interested in our causes. An integral component of the program is research and the opportunities provided to us in collaborating on this. Many of our projects benefit from collaboration with university research groups to fill knowledge gaps and improve management of threatened species. Dozens of threatened plant projects also benefit from collaboration with the different facets of botanic gardens, especially their seed bank team at Mount Annan and the Research Centre for Ecosystem Resilience in Sydney. This graphic is from one of the reports by RESA, that research centre, where they tested the genetic differences in subpopulations of Acacia miantha, which grows on the Central Tablelands. Unless anyone has questions about that brief intro, I will dive into the Bathurst grassland Eelas dragon, or to save my inevitable tongue tying, I might call it the Bathurst GED. So what is a GED? The name is somewhat self-explanatory, but there are some extra details to fill in the picture. GEDs are grassland specialists, but they aren't found in any old grassland. They are a Goldilocks species requiring certain habitat structure. The genus to which GEDs belong, Tympanocryptus, refers to the hidden ear, tympano meaning drum or eardrum, and cryptus meaning hidden. GEDs do not have the typical ear opening that most other lizards have. And like our small and mighty friend Spyro, for any millennials in the room, GEDs belong to the dragon family, Agamidae. There are 23 species of Tympanocryptus, but only 4 of these are grassland Eelas dragons. GEDs are the only members of the family Agamidae that are restricted to natural temperate grasslands. While we have 4 recognised grassland Eelas dragon species, this wasn't always the case. Up until quite recently, there was only 1 species recognised, Tympanocryptus pinguicola or lineata, depending on what point in history you look at. The colour plate on the left is one of the first depictions of a GED by Western science? In 2019, Dr. Jane Melville and others took an in-depth look at GEDs from various locations across New South Wales, ACT and Victoria through morphometric analysis, looking at features such as scale shape and genetic analysis. The team determined that there are four distinct species of GED. In the graphic on the right, you'll see our Bathurst GED noted as species B in light blue. And I'd also like you to take note of the underlined sentence in the Melville paper. Taxonomy and conservation of grassland earless dragons, new species and an assessment of the first possible extinction of a reptile on mainland Australia. We'll come back to this later in the presentation. So, as we've covered, GEDs are grassland specialists. There is some speculation that for Bathurst GEDs, favoured habitat may include open grassy woodlands. The Goldilocks species bit I mentioned earlier refers to the requirement for some grass cover, but not too much. This is because GEDs forage and bask in open patches, like you can see on the bottom right here. They predate upon invertebrates such as crickets, beetles, and ants. And other important habitat features include embedded rocks and cracking clays, which provide shelter. And perhaps the coolest detail is that GEDs shelter within wolf spider burrows. Here you can see a GED in a wolf spider burrow, which may lead you to wonder how small they are. The photo on the right provides a good frame of reference. GEDs are roughly as long as a smartphone, including the tail, or around 16 centimetres at most. So now for the Bathurst grassland earless dragon story. The Bathurst GED, though it didn't have a name at the time, was relatively well known among a few local herpetologists last century. In 1966, avid naturalists Uncle Ian McCartney and Gavin Waters collected two specimens and sent them to the Australian Museum. Over the next few decades, sightings would become less frequent. However, in the early 1990s, Dr. Will Osborne took a trip down to the ACT and collected two Canberra GEDs. On his return trip, he collected one Bathurst GED with Gavin Waters. This photo here showing the two Canberra GEDs next to the Bathurst GED. This is our only or one of two photos of the Bathurst GED that we have. So when Dr. Jane Melville and her co-authors began their research in 2018, the right people ended up talking and the frozen specimen was recovered. This provided the DNA essential to the study I mentioned earlier and enabled the researchers to confidently conclude that this is a unique species. The specimens collected in the 1960s enabled the researchers to comprehensively describe the morphology of this species. In recognition of his role in first collecting and sharing his knowledge of the species, one of the outcomes of the paper by Jane Melville was that the Bathurst GED was named after Uncle Ian McCartney, Tympanocryptus McCartneyi. That's Uncle Ian McCartney on the left. Also instrumental in our understanding of the species is Peter Carter on the right, who continues to provide us with advice on survey site selection. Unfortunately, the Bathurst GED is now known by some as the lost dragon. I note the intentional use of lost, not gone. There are only a handful of reported sightings in New South Wales BioNet from the 1960s and 1990s. And there have been no reported sightings of the Bathurst GED this century. What we don't know is whether this apparent absence of sightings is due to low detectability of the species, an absence or low abundance of the species, or low awareness of the species among members of the public. This brings us to the conservation status. In New South Wales, nominated species are assessed by a scientific committee established by the Threatened Species Conservation Act. If the assessment by this committee finds a species to be threatened, this is published as a final determination. The listing of the Bathurst Ged as endangered first occurred in 1996, when it was known as Tympanocryptus pinguicola, along with the other Ged species. And in 2022, the final determination was updated in recognition of new information, including the separation of the four Ged species, and the listing was changed to critically endangered, which, as you can see, is about as bad as it gets until we pop up to extinct in the wild. The reasons for listing, i.e. the bad news for the Bathurst Ged, are that the species is highly restricted. The Bathurst Ged has a very small area of occupancy, and all known sightings are from a relatively small geographical area. Since European settlement, 99.5% of natural temperate grassland has been destroyed or altered. Bathurst is Australia's oldest inland European settlement, so there is a long history of landscape modification. Habitat fragmentation. Because of this landscape modification, available habitat has become highly fragmented. The population size is unknown. We simply don't know how many Bathurst Geds remain in the wild. Habitat degradation, also a byproduct of landscape modification, where many of the habitat features important to the Bathurst Ged have been eliminated through rock removal, ploughing, and pasture improvement. There's also weed incursion. Increased weed cover outcompetes with native ground cover and changes habitat structure. Feral animals such as foxes and cats pose a direct threat to the Bathurst Ged through predation. And climate change has the potential to impact habitat quality, population resilience, and recruitment of all of the Ged species. Now, I'll remind you of the sentence I asked you to remember earlier on. The study by Melville and others described the first possible extinction of a reptile on mainland Australia. That was the Victorian grassland earless dragon. At the time of that study, it had not been sighted in 50 years. Well, in 2023, it was rediscovered. Ecologist Emmy Arnold found the Victorian Ged while assessing a site for new housing development. There have been some challenges in protecting this site, but captive breeding programs are underway. Aside from being fantastic news, this demonstrates that an absence of sightings does not always equal true absence. Geds truly can be difficult to detect, especially when we are thinking about incidental sightings by members of the public. So now to the Bathurst Ged Saving Our Species project. As this species is in the data deficient management stream, sourcing funding can be a challenge, but fortunately, we've been able to secure short-term project funding and underspends over the last few years to support the project. The main focuses of the project are targeted surveys, filling knowledge gaps where possible to determine the best approach to on-ground management, and community engagement to raise awareness of the species in Bathurst and surrounds. All of the Ged species are very lucky to have a dedicated field team who are passionate about searching for them. The Grassland Earless Dragon Alliance, pictured here, or some of the members pictured here, are a group of herpetologists and researchers who we have contracted for surveys over the last few years. Have a quick look at their logo and see if you can figure out what the dragon is sitting in, and I'll reveal the answer in the next slide. So how does one survey for a cryptic Ged? There are two main components to this. One is the deployment and survey of artificial refugia grids, basically a square of transects. And these grids contain artificial spider burrows and roof tiles. The burrows are made from PVC tubes with a rough inner surface. And here is the real life representation of the logo you just saw. A study by some members of the Alliance found that in a comparative analysis, artificial spider tubes were the most effective standalone refugia for detecting GEDs, and tiles were more effective when the air temperature was between 25 and 30 degrees Celsius. However, combining the two types of refugia into a transect or grid resulted in the greatest detection probability. And that's what you can see here with the green, of course, increasing with the number of repeat checks. The other component of surveys for GEDs is active searching, which involves rock rolling and inspection of natural wolf spider burrows with the use of an endoscope. This method has proven very useful for the Monaro GED. Community engagement is also an important focus of the SOS project on the Bathurst GED. The crux of the matter is, if people don't know about the dragon, how can they care? And if they don't know or care, how can we expect people to look after its habitat and encourage people to report sightings? Some of the engagement activities we've done over the last 2 years include running an awareness raising campaign, which included a media release, radio interviews, and social media posts. Special thanks to the Orange Field Naturalists for posting this on Facebook. A part of this campaign was running an expression of interest form for landholders to let us know they're open to hosting surveys, which resulted in 40 responses and some promising new survey sites. All of this also resulted in more potential sightings being sent to us at Saving Our Species, though these have invariably been Jackie dragons so far. We have also released a Farming for Dragons brochure, and I'll give you the QR code for this shortly. And last but not least, we installed a threatened species mural in Bathurst last year. This mural was installed by Wiradjuri artist Jess Leffley, aka Bird Girl Creations. And this photo shows the dragon part of the mural, complete with wolf spider and prey items. The finger on the left is an important component, as it shows viewers how tiny the dragon is. And you are among the first to find out that Jess used an important model for that finger. It was Uncle Ian McCartney. The aim of this mural is to raise awareness of the threatened species it features and foster a sense of pride and ownership of them in Bathurst community. The mural also features the purple copper butterfly, Burralong frog, and Granite Zaireia. So next time you're in Bathurst, make sure to swing by the Wombool Macquarie River Walk to see it. If you're familiar with the walk, it's between the showgrounds here and the river, and X marks the spot. So if you are interested in getting involved, here are some ways you can help. Whether you own land that could contain habitat for the Bathurst GED, or if you have a sphere of influence, so to speak, you can promote sympathetic land use. For example, retaining areas of native pasture, identifying areas of your farm that are dragon friendly, and in those areas, avoid rock removal, ploughing, and pasture improvement. If feral animals are an issue, work on controlling them, and remember that local land services can offer support. And you can manage stocking rates to get that perfect balance of not too much, not too little grass cover. You can report any potential sightings, and I encourage you to do so even if you're unsure what you're looking at. You can report those to savingourspecies@environment.nsw.gov.au. And you can get in touch with me if you like the idea of making some PVC spider burrows. The image on the right here shows the Farming for Dragons brochure where you can read more. And here is a QR code to download it directly to your phone if you want to take a quick snap. Does anyone have questions for that first part of the presentation before we go over to the butterfly?
It's me trying to come close. The microphone.
So I need to go over there.
It's easier.
Alison, it's Rosemary here.
Hi, Rosemary.
I've got two questions.
Yep.
One is, have you worked with any of the Wiradjuri community? And the other one is, have you approached Men's Sheds for making the burrows?
All right, starting with the Wiradjuri community, the mural was greatly supported by the Wiradjuri Traditional Owners Corp. So early last year when we did that awareness raising campaign, Uncle Jade was kind enough to post about it on social media. And a little while later, when I was thinking about the mural, I thought, oh, he's on site already. I'll see if he knows about any Indigenous artists in the area. So it was actually him and his group who recommended Jess Leffley to me. And they also helped with consultation throughout that process, letting the other Aboriginal groups in town know what was happening and seeking their feedback as needed. As for the Men's Shed idea, it's a fantastic idea. It's been very successful down, I think, in the Monaro region. Kuma Men's Shed was making burrows for the Monaro Ged. We did approach the Bathurst Men's Shed last year, but they didn't have capacity at the time to help with that. Fortunately, we've got a great volunteer who also works at an electrical supplier chain, so he's got good access to conduit and PVC. Adrian? You're on mute still.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Alison, I'm just curious. The Bathurst Grassland Alliance that has been putting the PVC burrows out, I'm just wondering, have they done much in the way of surveys using a drone?
No, I don't think I've ever mentioned them using a drone. Are you thinking in terms of finding prospective habitat?
Yeah, so mm-hmm. I've been independently searching for the GED for about 2 years.
Yeah.
And I've been using a drone to survey private land because obviously I can't get access. And I have, what I've discovered is that there's almost no habitat left that hasn't been alienated in some way.
Yeah.
Most specifically, the removal of surface rocks, because I consider that to be the most important component. I have actually, over the last two summers, isolated some areas that look promising, areas that if they did support populations in the past, they may still support remnant populations, but they're all on private land. One in particular is on a very large property, and it's isolated from all edge effects. It is unfortunately had been used for cattle grazing. Sheep would have been better, but they've had very low stocking rates. But it is private land, and so I can't see any way in the short term of getting access to it. But it's around the Newbridge area, which I found to be the most promising using my drone. I've also spent quite a lot of time looking on power line easements, railway line easements, council land, anywhere I can get access, even graveyards. And I've found a lot of lizards, and I've found a lot of areas with a lot of spider burrows, wool spider burrows, but obviously no GEDs. But I would suggest that using a drone to survey for potential good habitat is a very useful thing, considering that most of the areas that might house a population are private land.
That's really interesting, Adrian. I'd be keen to hear what you found and where you found it in terms of things that look like decent habitat. One of the challenges I didn't really go into in the presentation is the fact that many landholders are quite fearful that if a dragon is found on their land, it means that their property will be locked up.
Absolutely.
So we can provide all the messaging we intend, which is if the dragons are on your land, it means you're managing it perfectly and you don't need to change anything. But that fear still persists, and it does make it difficult to approach landholders. And I'm not sure how they'd feel about the government coming along with drones to look at their patch. Certainly with an existing connection, and this is something we can rely on local land services for, they can put us in touch with landholders. If we were to get permission to do a little site recce, then that sounds like a good way to cover a decent amount of ground in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah, no, I'd be happy to chat to you at some stage about what I have found out, because I have actually found out some useful information. I do actually also have a background in conservation. I worked for the New South Wales government for 10 years as a conservation manager. So I have a little bit of background there.
All right. Well, I'll chuck my email address into the Teams chat at the end of the presentations. I'm happy for anyone to contact me directly and share ideas or questions or suggestions. It's all gratefully received.
We've lost your presentation, Alison.
How's that? Have you got the butterfly?
No.
I'll just stop presenting and then reshare it.
Sweet, it's back.
Great. Are there any more questions or comments for the dragon before we jump into the butterfly? All good to go? All right, here's another tiny critter, the purple copper butterfly, or if you're ready for another acronym, the PCB. Throughout this presentation, I'll probably use the terms larvae and caterpillar interchangeably. Do let me know if this or anything else I say needs clarification. Some history. The purple copper butterfly is relatively new to Western science. In 1964, a single female was collected from a site near Bathurst by scientists who recognised it as an undescribed species from the genus Paralucia. At that time, only two other Paralucia had been formally described, and this genus sits within the family Lycaenidae, also known as the gossamer-winged butterflies. Many Lycaenid butterflies are associated with ants to differing degrees. Despite many searches, the purple copper butterfly was not rediscovered until 1977, when males, females, and eggs were collected for identification. Through observations of these specimens' anatomy, it was confirmed that they represented a new species, and the scientific name Paralucia spinifera was assigned by Edwards and Common. Spinifera refers to a spine-like process on the tibia of the butterfly's legs, which is absent or reduced in other Paralucia. At the time of naming, it was commonly known as the Bathurst copper butterfly. This name, as well as copperwing butterfly, are still used locally. Nowadays, the species is best known as the purple copper butterfly. The Bathurst Regional Council's logo features the butterfly. And this mural on the bottom left is dedicated to the butterfly. It's at a bus shelter in Cullenbullen. The purple copper butterfly is by all accounts a beautiful animal. Its upper wings show a shimmering iridescence of purple, copper, blue, green, black, and brown, most visible when in direct sunlight. Its underwings are marked with a pattern of brown, black, and grey, resulting in a cryptic appearance that is providing camouflage to the butterfly while it rests among grass with its wings closed. Unfortunately, their beauty has come from SOS. The Landcare Group engages trained bush regeneration staff to control blackberry, broom, pine, and other weeds in butterfly habitat in alignment with the conditions of a threatened species license. At two nature reserves, National Parks and Wildlife Service coordinate weed control within the core butterfly habitat. Feral animal control, for the most part, only takes place on National Parks estate. Considering the expertise and scale needed for this type of work, it's most effective in large reserves where a real difference can be made. Community engagement to raise awareness of the butterfly is an important component of managing threats and encouraging citizen scientists to report sightings. Local land services run an annual field day at Grant's Block Travelling Stock Reserve, which Saving Our Species contributes to with information, presentations, and practical support. We regularly run media stories to raise awareness of the butterfly in the Central Tablelands region. Although this year I'm focusing more strongly on visiting local schools to speak about the butterfly and hopefully inspire the next generation of stewards. Burning is a little more challenging. As you can imagine, lots of paperwork, approvals, and cross-agency collaboration is needed to implement an ecological burn. We can guide landholders through this process if they want to go down that pathway. We're in the process of organising an ecological burn trial using cultural burning techniques at Grants Block Travelling Stock Reserve, which is managed by local land services. At that site, we've established 10 burn plots to test the effect of fire on larvae abundance before and after burning. And when we get it happening, the burn will be implemented by Bathurst Local Aboriginal Land Council. With the investment of time and money into threat management, it is essential to conduct monitoring. There'd be little point in managing threats without knowing whether it's working. So we conduct annual threat monitoring, not only to tell us how well threat management is working, but also to help us prioritise sites and actions for the following year. We collect data on weed load and weed species, pig disturbance and canopy cover to determine where extra effort is needed to manage these threats. Collecting this data over long periods of time provides a basis for us to understand how the butterfly responds to the management actions that take place. We also conduct annual population monitoring across National Parks estate, private tenure, and public lands. This enables us to understand trajectories of species abundance and react accordingly if we detect a decline. It improves our understanding of how the butterfly can fluctuate in number across time and its capacity to recover after declines. While I've got some more data wrangling to do, I'm fortunate to have a data wizard as a colleague who can then analyse it so that we can better understand how different environmental factors, including presence of threats, have affected butterfly abundance over the last few years. So now just a bit more detail on the monitoring methods we use for the PCB. Adult monitoring takes place in one of two forms at all SOS managed sites, and threat monitoring nests within these methods. For most of the sites on private tenure, we conduct area searches during the flying season to take a snapshot of butterfly presence and abundance, as well as weed load and pig disturbance where those butterflies are sighted. At the sites that are more intensively managed, i.e. the nature reserves and the travelling stock reserve, we use a quadrat-based methodology, which includes a more in-depth look at vegetation characteristics within the quadrats, as well as assessment of the weed load and pig disturbance found. This threat and vegetation monitoring normally takes place before the flying season. Then we return to count the number of adults within quadrats when they're flying. For any method of monitoring during the flying season, it's essential for it to take place during ideal conditions. Windy, cloudy, or wet days will significantly affect the number of adult butterflies that are active, so we aim for still and sunny days. Also, at the quadrat-based sites, we conduct nocturnal larvae monitoring in December, which begins with a daytime visit to measure all tagged host plants within those quadrats, recording data on the size of those host plants, lichen load, reproductivity, and presence of sooty mold. Here we are measuring a 2 meter tall burst area. And these daytime visits are followed by those nocturnal visits to each tagged plant when we record larvae presence and abundance, the location of the larvae on the plant, as in how far up the plant they are, and the presence of the attendant ants. If you want to be a friend to the purple copper butterfly, here are some ways that you can get involved. My first suggestion, in similarity to the Bathurst grass and Illus dragon, is to promote sympathetic land use. In the context of purple copper butterfly habitat, this primarily means avoiding clearing, staying on top of weeds, and avoiding pesticides where possible. Understanding the butterfly life cycle will help you minimize impacts to the species while it's flying or on the host plant as larvae. It's important also to understand that these management actions benefit a whole range of threatened and non-threatened species alike. As many of us know, invertebrates as a group are in decline, and considering what you do on your property and when you do it can make a real difference to ensuring minimal impacts. You can also report sightings of the purple copper butterfly. I strongly encourage you to search for potential habitat and then visit during the flying season to search for it. Just last year, a naturalist discovered a previously unknown population while bushwalking. For some guidance on where to look and some tips on spotting butterflies, you can search for the purple copper butterfly threatened species profile. That's what's pictured here, and access the fact sheet. I'll also give you a QR code at the end of this if you want to put it on your phone. Also, do what you can to expand the butterflies friendship group. Share what you know and encourage others to learn about this fascinating species. Here's a quick look at that fact sheet I mentioned. It includes a whole list of tips to help with your search, observations to take note of, and how to report a sighting. Within these tips, you're recommended to get underwing photos of the butterfly if you can, because this can really help with identification. The fact sheet also includes some similar looking species to help with identification, as well as this species distribution model developed by my colleagues Dumi and Michael to help you know when to look. One thing to note is that this fact sheet suggests you report sightings via NatureMapper. Unfortunately, NatureMapper is in the process of being phased out due to funding shortfalls. So I encourage you to use whichever app or website you're used to, such as iNaturalist or Atlas of Living Australia. Or you can contact Saving Our Species at environment.nsw.gov.au. I'll chuck that email address in the chat along with my personal email address. Here's the QR code to download the fact sheet if you want to. and take any more questions, ideas, suggestions.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Paul is my name.
Paul.
Just a question of that coloured map of their location. It seems to be confined to the grasslands, and there's nothing in the mountains. Is that correct? The eastern mountain country.
I'll bring it up again. It's probably a little tricky to say with the scale you've got there. I don't pretend to understand how all of this works. As I said, my colleagues put this together, but the inputs they used were a combination of elevation. As we know, the butterfly and its host plant occur at elevations 850 meters above. Other inputs they used were presence of the host plant as per BioNet sightings. And I think they put in a few more inputs relating to vegetation class or type. So I would imagine that this does show up the more hilly areas or certainly higher elevations, and it should be covering pretty well the vegetation types needed by the butterfly. But when you do this type of model, it's not super fine scale. It sort of results in a grid pattern, and then the squares within that grid that are the best habitat are represented. So you're not going to get a great resolution from it. I hope that makes sense.
I'm up for now. Yes, still alive.
Hi, Alison, Dennis Marsh. Why does the attendant ant behave in the manner that it does?
That's a tricky question. I can't imagine what it's like to be an ant or to be that ant. It certainly makes sense that they've co-evolved together. The very fact that the ants are patrolling the host plant before the larvae ever hatch from an egg makes me think that they're detecting some sort of pheromone. And then, of course, when the larvae are a little bit later on in their development, they form that gland on their back that secretes a sugary honeydew. So the ants are certainly benefiting from that relationship. How it first happened, I'm not sure. It's common to a lot of Lycaenid butterflies. There are some species that have not just the three-way symbiosis, but a four-way symbiosis, including other insects and fungi and that sort of thing. So there's certainly a long evolutionary history to it. And yeah, I won't pretend to fully understand it all. I recommend you look up Lycaenid butterflies and how they co-evolved with their attendant ants.
There you go. Sandra here. I'm looking at the lilac patch to the east of Blaney. Is that the area proposed for McPhillamy's mine in that area? Maybe people in the room could.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with McPhillamy's. If anyone else can, I wonder if I can zoom into this. Perhaps not. I don't know if that's made it more pixelated for you, but.
Is that about where it's coming from?
It's the
pitch. We can look at it in the light.
Is there fun that has to come from the school?
That's a